This is the Living Legacy Project interview with Philip Burke on February 26, 2014. And Philip, thank you so much for coming in today and joining us here at the Birchfield Penny and participating in this project.
My pleasure.
So I'd like to get right into it and ask you, what inspired you to want to pursue a career in the arts?
The very beginning was actually in the basement of Rockwell Hall. I grew up in a large Irish Catholic family in North Buffalo, and my mom would take us on Saturdays, where it must have been students from, well, they called it state teachers, would teach us drawing classes in the basement. And I took to it. I loved it. But when I got serious was in high school. Now, let me backtrack. I think it was during those classes that I did a drawing of one-line contour drawing of the sculpture of the horse and rider. Is it a rider, horse and rider, outside the historical museum? You know that sculpture? And then it was put up in the class as being like a nice drawing. And that was my first memory of feeling like, oh, I could do something. But it was when I got more serious about it when I was sophomore in high school. I went to Calisanctius High School, and they had a program called, I think it was called the seminar program, but it was where you chose an area of study that you really enjoyed, and it was apart from all the classes. And I started getting into caricature, and I was really enamored with the drawings of David Levine, and I was doing drawings that were kind of influenced by his work. And I'm trying to remember the exact year, I think it was when I was a sophomore. I had done a bunch of drawings, and part of the study was meeting the local cartoonist. So I remember meeting the political cartoonist for the news. And I don't know if it was through him, but somehow I made a connection to Murray Light at the news. I was 15, I remember. And he did a full page on the weekend article showing my caricatures, and it was nice. It was really kind of exciting to me. But also, meeting him, he told me there was an artist from the Middle East named Lurie, and he said he had also pen and ink caricatures. Anyway, he told me how much that person made a year, and he said, I think it was $50,000 back then. And once I heard that, I thought, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And so even though from the point that I felt like I could do it and I wanted to do it, then I stopped taking the other studies really seriously and just put more and more focus on the caricatures. But that was my initial inspiration.
Mm-hmm. During that period, through the Buffalo News, did you meet Tom Tolles at all?
Later. Yeah, later. I met Tom Tolles. I'm trying to remember when I first met him. Was he doing work for the Courier?
I think so, yeah.
I think when I first met him, I had gone to Toronto for 2 years after high school, trying to go to university and not really taking it seriously. When I came back, this was, I think, 77, I was waiting tables here, and I would do one drawing a week for the roto section of the Courier. And I think Tom was doing work for the Courier at that time, and I think I met him at that time. That was my first, like, caricature gig.
Uh-huh.
It was crazy because I would do these big drawings and then they'd get printed like postage stamp size. But that's what I took with me when I went to New York at the end of 77. And I was so embarrassed about the way they printed them that I got a big portfolio with all the original drawings. But yeah, that's when I first met Tom. Years later, we did a presentation together at the historical. I think that was in the 90s. I've always found that working large really loosens me up.
Mm-hmm.
And also my whole, you know, you use your whole body.
Mm-hmm.
So you're standing up. And when I was in my 20s, I was really into going to the dance clubs, and particularly the punk clubs in New York. So it was a big part of my life back then, that energy, the energy of you know, that music that made you just want to move. So that energy has always been a part of my studio, always. Not that I'm literally dancing while I'm painting, but that same movement and energy. You know, as I got older, I couldn't dance anymore because I was very brutal on my body, especially with the punk stuff. But as with any kind of dancing, you can only do it for so long, but that same energy and that same kind of movement has always been a part of my painting. But even with drawings, even before I started painting, with drawings, if I knew it was going to be printed this size, I'd do it this size. I'd always do it two or three or more times larger because I felt that I could be looser, and then also it always tightened up really nicely. It would be richer when it was reduced. The physicality is a really big part of it. One of the nicest studios I had for 10 years, we rented a cottage across the border on Lake Erie, right on the beach. And that's when I was doing the work for Rolling Stone. And some of the most fun I had was painting on the deck on the lake. That was really nice. Just the physicality of it, that was nice. You know, I had gone to Calla Sanctus, and I don't know if you know anything about that school. I think it started in the 50s, but it was like for school for academically gifted boys. Then it became co-ed. But the idea was to push kids to go as far as they could, as fast as they could. So like when I first started there, they put me ahead a year. Some kids were put ahead more than a year. But through high school, you were taking, well, I think I started in grade 6, but in grade school, you were taking high school courses. In high school, you were taking college courses. And by the time I got to my junior year, I stopped studying, I stopped reading, I stopped doing it. I don't know how I graduated, actually. But that's also the school that had the program that got me in, you know, where I chose caricature. They really supported me in doing that, and that's probably how I graduated. But my parents were very much of the mind that you go to college or university, you know, no matter what, you have to do that. And high school is really a preparation for that. So I tried university in Toronto. But I was very kind of intellectual about it. I thought, all right, I'll take some art classes, and I guess I'll take art history, and I started with ancient art, and then I'll work with, and I was so bored, I couldn't even stand it. But I wasn't really there to take art classes. I was there to get my liberal arts. And I just, like I mentioned, by the time I was a junior in high school, I was kind of stuffed or overloaded with the academics, and I just couldn't get myself out of bed to go to class. Mm-hmm. But it was an opportunity for me to be on my own without the real scare of really being on your own. So it's like being in school but away from home. So that was great. And I also started doing drawings for the university newspaper. So that was my first experience of having deadlines and meeting them. And I had actually gone to, trying to remember how this worked, if I was going to try art school before that. Yes. I had gotten a scholarship actually to Cleveland Institute of Art, but that was a lot of pressure from my family to go to university, so I followed that. But when I went to New York, which was in 77, my first idea was I'll go to art school there. And so I went and visited Parsons and Pratt, I think, and Cooper Union. I think the door was locked. I had also gone and visited RISD. But my feeling when I went to the art schools, I was really not inspired. I was turned off. I felt, when I was in high school, I had this dream that, you know, I would have a life where, as a young man, I would be in a community of artists sharing ideas. And when I went to the art, and I thought that's what art school could be, but when I went there, I especially at the top art schools, I felt everybody was very guarded with what they were doing, like they had the next thing and they didn't want you to take it, that kind of real protective. There was no sense of what I had imagined. And then what really turned me off was the emphasis on crits. That's where the artists all put up their work and then spend a couple hours critiquing each other. And that's really, like, rubbed me the wrong way, goes against my grain, whatever. I just felt like, what a waste of time. Just do your artwork. Just encourage each other and do your artwork. But that was a big, and it probably still is, but that was a big emphasis in art schools that really turned me off. Mm-hmm. Also, I didn't have the patience. I just wanted to get to New York and get going. I found a few artists, and we became close. There was an artist named Steve Brodner, who's a well-known caricaturist. But particularly this one artist named Steven Croninger, who's one of the best collage illustrators, if not the best. We became real close. And another National Lampoon cartoonist who ended up being a writer for The Simpsons named Ron Howge. And that was kind of like, for me, a little community of artists who were, it wasn't the fine art world, it was more the editorial. I've always felt there was a kind of prejudice in the fine art world toward editorial work. I find that it just starting to loosen up. That's my feeling. I always felt that it would, because I remember when I was living in New York, just before leaving, which would have been early 80s, there was a show at the Modern called, what was it called, The High and the Low. And in the show, they were showing, you know, they were kind of presenting caricature, graffiti as fine art. That, you know, the art world hadn't really caught up to that yet, but I always felt like at some point that distinction would be blurred, and it feels like it's on its way. Also, as you can tell by looking at my paintings, I've always tried to create editorial illustration that was at the same time painting and art, you know, fine art, so to speak. Like, I was never happy to just do fine art, or I was never happy to just do illustration, but the hybrid is where I get excited.
Could you talk a little bit about your process of moving from pen and ink into painting? You talked about this when I came to the studio. Love it if you wanted to talk about it for me.
Sure. When I got to New York, I had, as I mentioned, the portfolio of the pen and ink caricatures, and I got work with it right away, and I got a lot of work. When I was there, I started to really get into Picasso's work for the first time. I'd always been in awe of it and always scared of it, but then, you know, as a high school student. But when I got to New York, I just loved it and dove into it. And then something started in me where I really wanted to paint, but I was so scared. I couldn't even consider. I was so scared of failure, so I was doing these pen and ink drawings, and then I slowly moved into colored pencil and started doing color that way, and just had this growing feeling like, I want to paint, but I can't. And then in 1982, I was introduced to true Buddhism and started chanting Nam-myoho Renge-kyo, and at that time, one of the immediate effects of my Buddhist practice was this feeling of total freedom. And it was like, it was really like waking up. It was like going from being asleep to waking up, but there was this just fearlessness. And also my girlfriend at the time, who had introduced me to it, really pushed me, like, just go get the canvas, just go get the paint, just go do it, just do it. But it was kind of like jumping off a cliff, but as soon as my mind opened up, there was no question that's what I wanted to do, and I just started doing it with results that I loved right away. And it was simultaneous with my first exclusive contract, which was with a newly reborn Vanity Fair. And so there was a place for the paintings to be published right away, and they were real excited about it too. For me, there was no real training in painting. It was just the little bit that I had learned about how the colors interacted with colored pencils. I think one of my brother's girlfriends at one point was taking painting and showed me what the color wheel meant. That's about the extent of my training. But it was just a matter of buying the color paints that I loved the most and made sure that I had enough of a representation of the color one, and trial and error.
And how do you find that that continues even now in how you choose the colors you use for example, the paintings you would do for Rolling Stones? You know, you use these very vibrant colors.
Actually, when I first started painting, I took a bit of an academic approach. I started really studying Manet, and of course, the work was always caricature influenced. And also, I think before I did my first painting, I was at a friend's studio, and she showed me a book of the Fauves. And so that was immediately attractive to me, and that was immediate, you know, I immediately got into the wild colors. But wild color, really, I really started to become comfortable with it, and it started to get really wild when I was doing the Rolling Stone contents page in the early 90s. I was being very inspired by the colors of Van Gogh and Matisse. When I first started painting, I noticed that if I could see a glimmer of a color in someone's face, in a little area of the face, and I amplified it, and I did that all over the face, it created a real 3D. If I was true to that, because in a face, the colors are so subtle, but if I was true to that glimmer of what I saw in the color, then I was always happy with the result when I amplified the color. And when that really started to become stronger is when I was doing the work for Rolling Stone contents page. The idea was always to have an image that took up a little more than half of the page vertically, so that, and with a white silhouetted against a white background, which I was used to doing anyway, because I, taking from David Levine and all the great caricaturists, there was these caricatures against white. So the art director's idea was that then the white background, so that you had this floating character and then all the contents on the white. So when he would get the work, there was always a little bit of, I don't know what the word, technical word is, but it would be like blown out so that the whites were really white in the background. And then as a result, I was losing the intensity of the color and then started to amplify my intensity of color in the paintings. And then it just became something where I couldn't stop and the colors just got more psychedelic. But over the years, I don't know how to say this without sounding strange or goofy or whatever, but colors themselves, I find, have personalities, really strong personalities that I have relationships with. So there's a real, in my mind, intuitive play happening with the colors and the subject. The colors really have strong personalities. I feel like I'm in, not conversation, but definitely like communication with the colors when I'm painting, and that they're communicating with each other.
Could you talk a little bit more about how your choice of subject matter affects color?
I don't think my mind works that way.
Yeah.
I think it's really intuitive in the moment, very much in the moment. And then a lot of things I'll see after the painting's done, and I'll see, like my imagination goes wild with what I imagine must have been happening in my mind, but it's very intuitive. I think that when I'm doing, say, a white male Republican politician, it's a little more challenging with the colors because their personality can be so controlled.
Mm-hmm.
Unless I'm really going to town. Oh boy, that's a good question.
I
do know that for me, my most enjoyable subjects are politicians and rock stars.
Uh-huh.
Rock stars because they're celebrating all the quirks of their personality, and politicians because they're trying to hide it, and it's the challenge to pull it out from behind the mask. I mean, I like painting anyone, really, but those are my favorite, politicians and rock stars. I find it's two different endeavors completely, but equally enjoyable.
What's your relationship with subjectivity or bias in your work? Does that come out, or do you try to...
When I have freedom, like with Rolling Stone, it really comes out. I can't stop it from coming out. Sometimes I have to be more controlled based on the publication. Like I have done Arnold Schwarzenegger many, many times and always have a lot of fun with him. But most recently I did him for a magazine in Sacramento, and it was clear from the magazine and from the article that it was definitely important that I do something more like a portrait and less like a opinionated caricature. However, more recently I think that my work has in the way that, well, I don't know, maybe over the last 10, 15 years, even if it's someone that I dislike or disagree with, I'll try to create an image that doesn't just show that, but shows many different sides of the personality. One of my favorite paintings is of George W., where even though I really go to town on him, there's a sense, particularly in the eyes, where you feel some sensitivity from him. I think that for me it's more exciting to create images now that are richer that way. But like when I was doing the Rolling Stone cut page, I couldn't help my own kind of editorializing sometimes when I would do musicians where I just thought the music was a waste. Or when I did someone who I just thought was a genius, you know, it would be clear. And also over the years of working for Vanity Fair, I think it's pretty obvious where my politics lie. In general, I think the history of political caricature, the best work is usually attacking the conservative. I think the most inspired work tends to be attacking the conservative. My very first influence, when I was in high school, I was studying Thomas Nast and Daumier and Hogarth and all the great political cartoonists from history. Then from there, as I mentioned before, David Levine's caricatures really caught my eye. And I was just totally in love with his work for a few years. And my early published work was like bad David Levine drawings. I remember when I brought that portfolio to New York and I had an interview at the Village Voice, and I walked in, the art director was all excited, and he was on the phone to somebody and he said, "Oh, I have this artist here who does these great David Levine drawings, David Levine-like drawings." And like inside I felt like, oh, but then I thought, that's okay, it's getting me work. But when I got to New York, along with David Levine, I was very influenced by and excited by the drawings of Ralph Steadman, the British artist who was doing political work for Rolling Stone magazine, whose work was a lot wilder. And then when I moved to New York, I was introduced to the work of Gerald Scarfe, and he's the artist you may be familiar with, the artwork in the Pink Floyd movie, The Wall. Before doing that, for many years, he was the caricaturist for the London Times, and he was famous for taking caricature to its extreme, and he was really good. Ralph Steadman is probably best known for his Fear and Loathing, and they were contemporaries, but it wasn't until I got to New York that I was introduced to Scarfe's work. And then from there, the person actually who introduced me to Scarfe's work was the art director at the New York Times Book Review. He also introduced me to the work of the artists in Germany who had their work published in something called Simplicissimus. And it was a group of German artists. The most well-known of them would be George Grosz, and I'm trying to think of some of the others, Bruno Paul and Olaf Gulbrandsen, just beautiful drawings. From there, I started looking, as I mentioned before, seriously at Picasso and really got into Picasso. And Matisse, Van Gogh, Modigliani, I would say that covers all the big influences for me. Once I got into Picasso, I stopped looking to the history of caricature and more to the fine art, particularly from the 1800s, mm-hmm. like in the early 1900s for inspiration. Mm-hmm. I think the very, very first, I have to say the very, very first influence, because it's always been in the back of my imagination and mind, is the animation, the early animations of, not early, but the animations of Walt Disney. Mm-hmm. The form and the animations of Walt Disney has always been a big, big part of my, the way I see things. I mean, before I was drawing or anything, you know, Sunday night, Walt Disney. I guess one thing I would say is that when I started, while I had chosen this and I couldn't really do anything else, obviously university wasn't for me or those studies, but I wanted to, how can I say this? While I was here, before moving to New York, after I was in Toronto, it was like a little over a year, and I was waiting on tables and doing the drawings for the Courier. When I got to New York, I just determined, I'm not going to do anything but draw. It was like do or die, because I wanted to spend all my working time in art. So I was talking about this roundabout, but basically I knew the only way to do that, and also given my inclination for caricature, was to do commercial illustration. So for many years, I didn't pick up a pencil or pen unless I had an assignment for many, many years. Then, I don't know when this would have started, probably when I started practicing Buddhism, or maybe a year before that. And also when I started painting, I started doing more drawings for myself. I don't know what ended up, but like very early 80s, I started, must have been Picasso. I started just drawing and drawing and drawing, where it was just people in my environment, or And then over the years, whenever I've had some free time, I would do personal paintings. But overall, there's always been that kind of, I like to say, mercenary approach, where if there wasn't an assignment, I wasn't going to be doing drawing or painting. And then during the 90s, when I was doing the Rolling Stone contents page, I became really, really busy. A lot of people were seeing the Rolling Stone work. And then I realized if I did more than the illustration work, I would have no life. A big part of the passion comes from the knowledge that I'm communicating with many people. And even though I'm not meeting them, there's a sense of being on stage, with comfort of not being on stage where people are judging you in the moment. But there's never a time when I'm not in the studio with that feeling like you're on stage. Right now, you're gonna, you know, there's a lot of people watching. And there have been several times when I've had ongoing work, like with Rolling Stone or The New Yorker or The New York Observer, where you know that there's an audience developing, that they're seeing piece by piece by piece. So that relationship with the unknown audience, or that sense of, even though it's one way, that sense of communication has always been really exciting to me. But also, I think the freedom that caricature provides, I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but the thrill of caricature, I'm addicted. I got addicted at a young age. I can't not do it. There's a something about once, this is something we haven't talked about at all, process, but once the rigorous study work is done in pencil, the thrill of, it's like, I don't know, the only thing I could compare it to, it's not anything I've ever done, but like skydiving or something, but the thrill of the unknown, or the thrill of something happening on the canvas and you don't know what it is. Actually, it never happens without an assignment. When I'm doing paintings that aren't an assignment, they fall more into the, I would say, category. The only way I could describe it is like kind of impressionist / expressionist, not really caricature, but that mind space of caricature. It's so exciting and rewarding, and I'm so addicted to it that luckily I never have that problem of I'm not sure exactly how you put it, but that, you know, my passion being dampened because it's what I'm doing for work.
That's an awesome perspective.
Luckily, it's been a beautiful combination from the time I was a kid. You know, I feel so fortunate. I don't know how I'm wired, but to go after that as a young kid. I mean, when I remember going through my junior year in high school is so hard, right? Because you still have your senior year, but you're facing that sense that, like for me, as my studies went down, there's that unbelievable fear of failure, of life failure, right? Because of the way, at least I was programmed. I remember that incredible fear, but at the same time that I couldn't not do the caricature. I couldn't stop it, I couldn't not do it. That was crazy going to New York, it was crazy. I was 21, and I got $100 in my pocket, and I knew one person who I could stay with who was a friend of my sister's husband. And then met one person, another person, ended up, it's crazy. I was invited to visit, let's see, a boyfriend of a girlfriend of my twin brother's girlfriend in New Jersey. And I remember I was being driven to this place and pulled into the driveway, and I saw this little Volkswagen with brake lights and turn signals were little neon hands. And I was like, whoa, what's that? And I had, before going to New York, I had worked at Mulligan's on Hurdle, and they had their neon palm tree, and I was like, what's going on here? And I went in and I met this artist who was visiting also, another person in the family, and we like got on House on Fire. We just really related. And he was this crazy artist who had done light shows for Velvet Underground, and now he was single-handedly bringing neon back. He had this place called Let There Be Neon, and he basically created the revival of neon in the late 70s. And he had a gallery on West Broadway in Soho, which was this crazy place. But anyway, in this conversation we had, I told him, you know, what my dreams were and what I was about, and he said, wow, I'm going to Europe for a week, but when I get back, if you're still here, you can sleep on the gallery floor. So for a month and a half, I slept on the floor of this gallery. And this gallery was crazy because it was the walls were created to be like caves, and they were like molded like caves, and then there was this neon all over. But I slept on the floor there, and during the day when they were making their neon, I had a little drawing table, and I would be doing drawings for the Village Voice or New Times, and then pretty quickly got the money to get an apartment. This guy was wild. He was this crazy acid head. He was still doing acid. He was in his, I would say he was in his 50s by then or 60s. But anyway, he made sure that he helped me find a place in the safest neighborhood in New York, which was the West Village. And it was crazy. But there was this, somehow I was able to, I guess I was born with it. I don't know. There was this sense of nothing to fall back on. I was from a large Irish Catholic family, which was very repressive and very controlling, and was basically asked to leave the home after I flunked out of university. And so there was no security there, and there was really not, it was like going to New York with nothing to fall back on, I think was a good thing for me. There was no, I wasn't trained for anything else. It was really do or die. It was the time, I'm fortunate with the timing, because it was such a different time. It was the end of a certain time where when I was in this gallery on West Broadway between Prince and Spring, I would go around the corner, and on Spring Street was a magazine shop. Literally any magazine that I picked up that had work that was at all wild or exciting illustration, just go to the masthead, call the art director, and have a interview like that, and time with the art directors. It was just, it was dreamy. It didn't last more than 10 years, but it was really good timing. New York was still a cheap place to live, and you could meet art directors just like that. Well, it's interesting what's going on with this Rolling Stone Germany. Art direction is done by a group called Favorite Picture, which I think is a picture sourcing place. And one of the men who started that is a man named Max Miller, who was working with me, I want to say about 10 years ago, Vanity Fair Germany. I think they died since then, but they were using me close to 10 years ago. And at the time, he was very excited about, oh, somehow we got to get you a show here, which never happened. But now, with the work that they're getting, that I'm sending, they're very excited about it, and they're talking about they want to represent me in Europe. So we'll see. I don't know. It's all talk until something happens, but I think Buffalo has great potential right now in the arts. You know, it might be my imagination, but even 10 years ago, Buffalo, in terms of the people, it didn't look like this. Now it looks like some, almost like Exodus from Brooklyn or something with these hipsters. I mean, it doesn't look like Buffalo, but I don't think it's a bad thing. I think, 10, 15 years ago, Buffalo just felt so drab, dead.
And it's interesting to see a little bit of what's going on with Mark Goldman down in Allentown here.
Yeah.
You know,
why do you say with Mark Goldman?
The Allen Street Art Collective.
I don't know about it.
Okay. Do you know where Hardware Cafe is?
Oh, sure. No, Mark, I actually painted as part of the same series that I did Joanne.
Did you?
Yeah, so I met him.
Funny.
I had kind of met him at a distance when he was at Calumet. There was some miss things. We kind of missed each other. But I actually, you remember John Bartolome?
Yes.
His daughter, who is the LB of LB Madison, is a friend of Mark's. So when I had to do Mark for the news, she set up a meeting. And so I saw what he had done on the wall at Hardware, but that's all I knew. That was a while ago when there was a big mural. Now I notice that's more subdued, but all over Allen.
Right, and so it's not that, so he essentially organized a group of artists, both local artists and the artists from New York and LA, and artists who are now in New York and LA who have a Western New York connection. He brought them all back to do a mural project down.
Oh, that's what's going on.
And he helped organize all of that.
Now, who's the artist who did the big mural on Elmwood? The main figure is a black woman.
Yes,
Augustina.
Yeah.
Yes, I met her, I met a young, I don't know what you would call it, he's in charge of some kind of city thing in Niagara Falls, who was very interested in trying to get me involved in doing some of that kind of work, and so they brought me together with Augustina, and there's another artist, a well-known Buffalo artist, I'm drawing a blank on his name, but anyway, you have to be really dedicated, because the money, even though there's money, when it comes down to it, what I found out, I know, once you have the supplies and the materials and everything, what's left is kind of starving artist. But she does beautiful work.
Yeah.
I think I would shy away from it in the same way I never picked up the airbrush. I just need the stroke.
Yep.
The stroke is, you know, that extension of drawing that is just informs the image with so much personality. Yeah, but I've always dreamed of doing mural work. Mm-hmm. Just need the budget. Mm-hmm. always dreamed of doing mural work.
So, Philip, could you talk a little bit about your creative process and maybe what your creative process has looked like at different points in your career? Maybe, I don't know if there's any comparison between, you know, where you're at with Vanity Fair or The Village Voice in comparison to Rolling Stones or even Rolling Stones Germany? That's a big question.
Yeah. The creative process for me has always followed a certain course that hasn't changed too much, which is before going to do caricature, I'm gathering as much reference material as I can and starting with realistic drawings. Actually, some of the realistic drawings are like super real, not in the sense of super realism though, like really taking the time to do a drawing that's almost like a medical drawing, you know, like just exactly what I'm looking at and trying to draw from as many angles as possible. So nowadays it's real easy to find, relatively easy to find both profiles, both three quarters, and many images, you know, in between. It's varied over the years of how many drawings I do before going to caricature, but I'm comfortable with getting both profiles, both three quarters, and then at least a couple more head on, and then starting to do, you know, some figure drawings, and, you know, not figure, literally figure drawings, but drawings of the figure, posture, all in pencil. I'm very particular, I like 4B. It's not too soft, not too hard. I'm really finicky with my materials. But most of the work that I'm doing now, as I mentioned before, is really controlled in the sense that the art director or an editor need to see where I'm going with it. So they need to see a sketch that's gonna be what the final's gonna look like. So after doing the straighter drawings, I will work up a caricature. But I think what's exciting about the work that I'm doing for Rolling Stone is that there's a big difference between designing, so to speak, the final piece with pencil on paper and the organic quality of it happening on the canvas as it's being painted. I think the most exciting work is when it's really being designed as it's happening from, you know, informed by the drawings that I did in my mind, but not so much being stuck, you know, attached to a drawing that it has to reflect. The process in terms of the painting is typically 4 feet to 5 feet, sometimes even 6 feet, loud music. I don't know exactly what to include, but you know, I have a palette, all my favorite colors around the side with white in the middle. I can tell you what my colors are.
Please.
Starting with phthalo blue, ultramarine blue, dioxazine purple, alizarin crimson, permanent rose, cadmium barium red deep, cadmium red light, cadmium orange, cadmium lemon, permanent green light, phthalo green. So those are my favorite colors, either on their own or how they mix with a little bit of white. And it's a nice spread around the color wheel. Nowadays, as I mentioned, I'm able to get a lot more reference. Nowadays, more and more, a big part of it is video, like watching the person, which is very easy to do now between YouTube. And so I'm able to watch them and get, and it makes the image richer to see their personality. But once I'm ready and I have my palette, then I have two easels, and on this easel is a big foam core board with, you know, 20 or 30 pictures, and I'm setting them up like Let's say this is the board, and I'm standing here, and the painting's here. The main image that I'm working from, or main few images, are here, kind of to the right. Uh-huh. And like, usually I can get four rows of 8x10s, mm-hmm. however many, but on the second row, the main images that I'm working from will be like here. And then all around, the images are set up where it's like profile, profile, three-quarter, three-quarter. So it's like looking as much as possible at all sides in a very methodical way. So the preparation is really methodical and really I've developed over the years that feel comfortable with. But then when it comes time to painting, particularly with the Rolling Stone work or where I have the freedom, it's just, it's really like a dance. It's really very intuitively, and you know, it's got to be music that I feel like I could dance to. It's got to be music that gets my blood going. And it's very kind of an organic, intuitive, like incorporating different parts of different photos. Yeah, it's, you know what? Cubism had a big effect on me, but it's almost like the cubism is inside it. Like I don't leave the jarring breaks. Like they kind of finesse them. But cubism is, you know, the whole idea of seeing things from different angles at once, you know, is a big part of what I'm doing. My musical awakening was the punks. So I, as I mentioned before, I grew up in a very repressive household, although we did listen to some music, but it was really not until I moved to New York. And I, when I moved to New York, it was 77, so it was like right when that was going on. And that was really, you know, that I woke up, I was like, something's happening here, and it coincided really nicely with where I was at in my life. So when I first started, it was more with the drawings in New York, Clash, Elvis Costello, Talking Heads, and so many others, but those would, Patti Smith, that was the music that really would get me going early on. Yeah, well, there's been a progression where when I was doing the Rolling Stone work in the 90s, I was really into both Nirvana and also one group that really got me going was Garbage. I really, because I felt like they had some of the energy of what the punks were doing in a 90s kind of way, but also African. Mm-hmm. I got really heavily into African music in the 90s. I had met a drummer from Senegal here and became close for a little while, but was totally woken up to the West African rhythms, the polyrhythmic stuff, and that really went well with the way I was working when I was doing the Rolling Stone work. Then, more recently, I totally rely on my son. And it's like, whatever strikes me, but I'm always hearing music of more today. Like, most recently, the music that I was working to was Arcade Fire and Mount Kimby and Beach House, among a lot of other ones. But I went through a period for 2 years, which just ended, where all of a sudden, I had a hard time working to rock and roll. Mm-hmm. And this was after 20, 30 years of always needing that dance kind of. And the reason was because all of a sudden, I was finding claustrophobic with the rock and roll because I always knew when the CD would end. I'm kind of a caveman when it comes to technology. I still am playing CDs. But I would know when the song was going to end. I would know when the CD was going to end. And I needed freedom from that. So for about 2 years, I did all my work to Miles Davis' Kind of Blue because it would never got old, and I never know where I was in it. There were two CDs, Kind of Blue and Miles Does the Classics, one after the other, and that was 2 years. It was like 2 hours in the studio. It was perfect for a segment. But that ended again. Now, right now, the music that I'm finding the easiest to work to is Nevermind, Nirvana. And I can listen to it over and over. Probably drives my family crazy, but mixed with some of the music, some of the today's music, but Nevermind has this quality. Kurt Cobain's music has this quality that I don't know how to describe, but I'm able to see everything really clearly and able to move a little more slowly. But there's something about the space that he created, the mind space that he created, that works really, really well with painting in terms of mostly being able to stay simple and see the whole picture all at once. It really works well. So I don't know where I'm going to go from there. I'm always feeling like I'm in and out of the desert when it comes to music. But I have to say that the amount of exciting new music that was happening in the late 70s was great. That time period of music was just great, and it was such a great asset to my, you know, work, my work in the studio.
Do you listen to artists you like when you're doing a portrait?
At least once. Mm-hmm. During the sketch process. If I don't like the music, I won't listen to it more than once. But I'll know from listening to the music where it fits into my critical analysis of music in general, or what I love. I think there was a time, and I think it was kind of came to a peak when in the 90s when I was doing the Rolling Stone work, where I was really, really opinionated, and that would come out even in my music caricatures. Now I think less. I think I've become more open to different things. But I will... Like, for example, when I did Noel Gallagher, you know, I could only take a couple live YouTubes, and it was like, this is really boring. But it really helped me. So when I'm painting him, no, I'll go back to whatever it is that's turning Man of the Time. Like when I was doing the Rolling Stone work, there was a long period where I was doing everything to Garbage Version 2.0. Mm-hmm. So I would listen to the other alternatives that they were giving me, all the alternative artists at that time, and I would listen to one or two, you know, the CD once or twice, and then go back to Garbage. One of the great things about doing musician, as I mentioned before, is like you just can feel so much about the person's inner life from the music. But then I need something that'll make me dance. I remember when I was in my 20s, I was so particular. I would be in a club, and if the music didn't pick me up, I was not going to try to dance, no matter who wanted me to. Of course, I can't say I was a great dancer because I wasn't good at dancing with other people. Mm-hmm. I was very much, you know, kind of like let the music make me crazy. But if the music didn't pick me up off the seat, then I wouldn't dance. And it's kind of like that in the studio. If it doesn't make me feel like I want to dance, I'm not going to paint to it.
Can you listen to it in other aspects of your life? If it's a good musician or a good album, but you can't dance to it?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, a good example of that is, have you heard King Cruel? He's a really great new artist from the UK. I think he's still in his teens, or if he's not 20 yet. But it's that he has the appearance of one of the ska artists, but it's not ska. Mm-hmm. But it's really unique. Yeah, that's another group of music that I was listening to in New York, was the Specials and English Beat. Well, there was so much great stuff all at once back then. Funny thing is, this is kind of come out of nowhere, but before I was seriously doing caricature, what I was doing was always doodling in my notebooks. Way, way back when, I don't know how old I was doing little drawings of my imaginary bands with the musicians playing their instruments. And I don't know, it's weird that it was always there. And also when I was looking at Ralph Steadman's work when I was in high school in the Rolling Stone, I always felt like someday Rolling Stone, you know, it was inevitable. It just felt like destiny that I would work for Rolling Stone. And it was not easy. Even though I got a lot of work right away when I moved to New York, Rolling Stone was a hard nut to crack. It took 10 years of going there. Every time there was a new art director, I'd go meet the new art director. But it took 10 years to break through wherever it was. And then I got the greatest gig that an illustrator can get when I did the contents page. It was unusual because, first of all, almost no magazines will give you, like, what do you call it, regular real estate on their pages. But Rolling Stone had a thing where for a long time they had the same artist doing the lead review for maybe a year, for maybe 2 years. But after 10 years of trying, I met this one art director, Fred Woodward, who we just clicked, and I was all over him. I even saw what he was doing in Texas before he moved to New York, but when Rolling Stone took him on, I was just literally all over him. I was back here in Buffalo, but I flew to New York, and I went, you know, I met him, and I was like, what are we going to do? We're for a perfect mix, what are we going to do? And he came up with this idea for the contents page. But there was never any promise beyond the page I did, but it lasted 7 years, which is unheard of. I just kept doing work, and they were happy with that, and so every other week for 7 years. I don't know how I got onto that, but... Oh, yeah, when I was a kid. There was just that sense of something about doing rock and roll musicians.
When you were a kid, did you want to be a musician?
I'd had a period where I had this dream of being, but it was the ego, the rock star thing. Not that I didn't love music, but I had nothing in me, the patience or even the inclination to learn music. But I always thought, you know, maybe I'll be a singer or something, but it was more fantasy. It was in terms of what I really wanted to do was always the drawing. But I always have this attachment to it, starting with the punks, this attachment to rock and roll. So it just felt like it took a really concentrated effort to make it happen at Rolling Stone, but it always felt like one day it'll happen at Rolling Stone. It just seemed like a natural fit. I don't really see anything with Buddhism and rock and roll, but I guess the best way to describe it is, I mentioned briefly before, when I was 25 when I first heard about the practice of true Buddhism or chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, and after having been born into a Catholic family, very strict Roman Catholic family, and I remember losing my faith, or realizing I didn't have any faith when I was 7, but having to go through the motions until I was booted out of the house, I think it was around 18, and then having nothing, no religion, no philosophy, no anything, just kind of, I don't know if you would call it agnostic or existentialist or punk or whatever it was, but there was really nothing religious. I think inevitably what I had learned from the teachings of Jesus was in the, you know, was kind of my helm, like what was true about it, how you treat other people. But when I was 25, I was going through big crisis in my life. I had been in New York for about 5 years, and on the outside, everything looked great. I was just on the verge of signing this exclusive contract with Vanity Fair. My work was really well received, living in the West Village. Had a nice relationship with a young actress. Everything on the outside looked just, but on the inside, I was dying. I was turning into a big pit, kind of a pit of despair. I was, you know, as a result of being this kind of judge as a caricaturist, and the early success leading to an inflated ego, I was just on the verge of getting some real fame, I guess. But inside, I felt really hollow and cut off from everybody. No one was close, even though I had a lot of relationships. And really had no hope for the future. This was around the time of Reagan, and I was getting involved in, I think at that time it was the nuclear freeze in New York, and trying to get involved in political art things, but felt really no hope for the future. And also literally was developing an ulcer. I think all the anger that had fueled me, you know, starting with being thrown out of my home, but also kind of like going to New York and identifying with the punks, and the anger was really my fuel. It was really getting me where I needed to go. And it was like a suit that I wore or something. I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but it was eating me up. And at that time, I took a trip home to visit, you know, just to get out of New York, just to breathe, and hooked up with an artist friend who turned me on to this practice, and then met the woman who ended up really teaching me about it, and I ended up getting married to. And for me, the immediate effect from the very start, the first day I started chanting, was a sense of hope and a sense of feeling my connection to all the life around me immediately, like waking up to a dimension that was there that I didn't know was possible. And also freedom, just the sense that anything was possible. And so many things happened at once. But as I mentioned before, I felt fearless to just jump off that cliff and start painting. But also I started to immediately be able to perceive my own behavior. So I had this image of myself as this really great guy. But once I started practicing Buddhism, you can't practice Buddhism and not see yourself. And I started to hear myself, and I started to see how nasty I was, how kind of a mean person I was. I noticed that every time I was in a conversation, I was constantly putting down many people in the same conversation. It was like I was addicted to it, that vitriol or whatever. So I remember, I think I realized I should just shut up. I think for about a year I said very little, did a lot of chanting. But The effect, I think, has been gradual but palpable in my artwork. I hope over the years my artwork, I think, has become much more accessible because I became more accessible as a person. And it's been a slow process, but a real process of from just caring about myself, which was, I suppose, necessary for survival at the beginning, but had gone too far, from just caring about myself to slowly letting other people in, slowly becoming concerned about other people, you know, the compassionate part of my life waking up. I think that the effect of that in my paintings is that they became easier to look at, easier to almost climb inside of. And it's really noticeable in a lot of the work. I think maybe a lot, especially a lot of the rock and roll work with the eyes. You know, they say the eyes are the windows to the soul. But I think that the paintings reflected that more open quality that my life was developing or has developed over the years. And also, as I mentioned before, my work became less showing a particular side of a person, but trying to show each person as many-sided. So I'm sure I could say more about it, but that's definitely what immediately comes to mind. Also, art shifted from being the center of my life, and people and other people and my concern about, you know, the future of the planet became more the center of my life, because this particular form of Buddhism is not, it's not meditation, and it's not like Tibetan, it's not esoteric, it's very much about, based on the law of karma, what can you do while you're alive to help move this planet toward peace? And it really has to do, in a simplistic explanation, is how your behavior changes and how you can not just dedicate your life to your own enlightenment in this lifetime, but how much you can share it with other people, let other people know about the Buddha nature that they possess that they're not aware of. So that really, over the last 20, 30 years, but especially last 20 years, has really become, I would say, the center of my life. And the art, starting with the relationships, but also the art reflects that. It's like my passion for life is like my body, and the artwork is like my shadow. So life has become much richer. So I hope that explains a little bit, but
it's really, really phenomenal.
It made life interesting for sure. I thought my life was over when I was 25. I've never been into a lot of heavy drugs, but I'd done enough experimenting in New York, and along with where I felt like, okay, that's not taking me anywhere either. I had no faith or belief system. It just felt like, okay, my life's over, I'm 25. It's gonna be just, I gotta settle. But from day one with this, it's like, keeps life interesting, rich, living from a deeper level, the deepest level. The one last thing I'll say is, and this is kind of a simplistic description again, but there is a consciousness, deep, deep consciousness, much deeper than our subconscious, which is, I don't wanna say a universal consciousness, but there's a depth within our own consciousness that all life is one, and that's a central thing in Buddhism. And it's not an easy practice, it's a rigorous practice, but once you touch it or experience it, it's not like you can ever forget it. It's really literally like from being asleep to waking up. There is a consciousness with our own life where we are one with everything, and there is a potential to feel it and act on it. And that's so far, it's not separate from art, but it's so much deeper, it's so far beyond it. But it's really exciting to see what happens with the painting because of that, and not just because, well, I just finished, I think, my 31st year of practice, so it's not just because of the time of practice, but before I do a painting, I'll chant for 3 hours. And what is happening, and as you mentioned, the difference between seeing it on a page or seeing the canvas, but what's happening on the canvas is so much more alive and exciting And there's lots of ways I could try to describe it because of my imagination when looking at it after it's painted, but it doesn't really do it justice. It's more, I remember hearing, when you wake up your deepest heart, the resulting creation is so much more alive, even if it's not a live model. I think the most exciting, this is another topic, but the most exciting work for me is when I have a live model, mm-hmm. because I find that the work itself, the painting itself, has a much richer life, vibration, whatever. When you're working from life, the life condition, the life, the vibration, the life of both people are in the canvas. They're existing in the canvas. The painting is made of both lives until it disintegrates. When you're working, as much as I try to assimilate that from working from photos, essentially it's just your life. So the result for me is that I can only live with my caricatures for so long on the wall, and I have to get rid of them. But the paintings I've done from life, I can live with 20, 30, 40 years. It's just so much, that's another topic. But I like to think about, when I think about that, I like to think about the work of, contrasting the work of Rembrandt, and I think one of his contemporaries was Frans Hals. And Frans Hals, no doubt, was a master. But the difference, because I remember being, I guess it would be the Metropolitan, being in a museum, seeing both of the work. Frans Hals, you stand in front of the Frans Hals, and it's so uncomfortable. It's like you're being analyzed or criticized by the painting. And you stand in front of you go across the room or whatever and stand in front of a Rembrandt, and you feel like so warm, and you feel like you're in a conversation with the person in the painting. So it's really the life of the artist. It's the heart of the artist. You know, Frans Hals was perfectionist. I mean, his paintings are phenomenal, but I can't help but think that his personality was not so nice. He didn't have the compassion for the other person. He had the ability. Whereas Rembrandt, you know, you just feel his heart. You feel like he's touching you. Anyway, this went around the block.
That was a great block to go around.
When I think about that, it's changed. Of course, when I was young, it was just, I want to be the best. Mm-hmm. I want people to remember my work or be familiar with my work thousands of years from now. One thing I've never lost is that kind of fantastical idea that I'm communicating with Van Gogh and Picasso and artists hundreds of years from now, being part of that flow. But in terms of achieve with my art, I'd like to be a part of the breakdown of that prejudice between fine art and commercial art, but that's superficial. I think mostly when I think about that kind of a question, it's feeling like I hope my art encourages people to just follow nothing but their passion, not to feel limited about, you know, what will be accepted or not, but just to listen to that voice inside or whatever it is, or that urge, and just, you know, follow that with their whole heart. Artistically, I'd like to be an inspiration for people to enjoy painting. It's scary what's happening. Even in a simple thing like you can't get good turpentine anymore. Literally, you can't get good turpentine. I don't know if maybe if you go to Europe. But it's like fewer and fewer people are painting. So even materials are harder to get. Good materials are harder to get. But I think, you know, there's nothing in the digital realm that can compare with the actual painting. But I guess I don't really think about that too much. I do like, I always, you know, from the time I was really young, I just love that sense of there's somebody in my environment. I've just done a piece of work. I can show it to them and get a spark out of them. That I think will always be there. And actually, I mean, I guess it's part of being an artist, but ever since I was just a kid, every time I had a drawing that I liked, it was like I immediately showed it to everybody who was around. That hasn't changed. I've had a little bit of that with posting each piece as it gets published on Facebook. Never quite took to Instagram, although a friend of mine was really pushing me to do that. But I like that immediate feedback on Facebook. That's nice. And get reaction, mm-hmm. get response, mm-hmm. get comments. I mean, Facebook for me is total art sharing.
Yeah.
and it's mostly artists, not all artists, but it's always been real positive for me. I don't get personal on Facebook. It's really about the art.
Yeah.
And so maybe because of that, it just stays real positive.
The first is that, and this is, you have touched on this in many ways, but is there anything else you could say about what you've done personally to advance your career in the arts?
I mean, this isn't actually answering it completely, but I will say that at the beginning, it really was 90% hustle, 10% drawing, and gradually 75% hustle, 25% drawing, and then 50-50. And then in the 90s, it became like no more hustle because of the recognition of the Rolling Stone work. I got so much work, I had to start turning work down from time to time and stopped looking for work for many, many years. And then that was a little crazy because that part of me kind of atrophied. And then after, you know, starting with 9/11, as everything changed, that hustle part of me was like completely asleep and weak. And so it's been a slow process of trying to wake that up. Luckily, I've done a lot of work. So this is a really bizarre and scary time for commercial art, especially editorial, because it feels like you're running toward a cliff. You know, everything's going digital and there's no budgets for illustration. But luckily, because of all the years of art that I've done, the hustle part has to do with like what I'm doing here with Tony and moving towards showing paintings.
It's a different kind of hustle.
Yeah, very different. And also, I mean, I don't know, this doesn't exactly answer the question, but it's always been a dream of mine to do more personal work. Mm-hmm. Like, I've always had the example, of course, of Andy Warhol and Edward Hopper, who kind of went from the commercial world into the fine art world. It's always been a dream. So it feels now like a necessity. But I'm really, really glad I have all those years of caricature behind whatever, you know, my personal work will be. I have a feeling my personal work will always be kind of retro in the sense of more to do with expressionism than conceptual.
Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for emerging artists? Mm. But another way to ask that, if that's too big or vague or anything like that, if you could tell yourself anything when you were starting out, what would that be?
It's a difficult question. It's kind of difficult. When I first started, it was like a handful of caricaturists. And then 80s, 90s, there was, I guess it's been called like the new wave of caricature. Like there was the renaissance of caricature, which is the generation before me with David Levine and Stedman and Sorel and all these artists. And then there was this explosion of caricatures, 80s and 90s. And then during that time, every school, starting with art schools and then universities, community colleges, every school developed an illustration department. All of a sudden, there's just like tons and tons and tons of illustration and caricature. And then not long after that, you have the economy where it's, you know, really difficult for illustration and caricature. I guess the most encouraging thing that I could say, although sometimes it's even hard to believe, used to be very easy to believe, but if you really pursue what you enjoy doing the most, then the audience will come to you or the appreciation will come to you. My mentor, David Levine, he was the first caricaturist I met when I went to New York. I remember when I started painting, he said to me, "This will never work. Painting and caricature will never make." But I think that not trying to overthink things and just follow exactly what you want to do the most in art, I really believe that. Yeah, I have to say I still do believe it. Appreciation will find you, people will find you, outlets will find you. Not that you don't have to exert yourself to find work, but I think not settling for doing work that you think people want or that you think will be saleable, but just really developing what you feel you have to do, like really taking what you love doing the most to its extreme. think you'll find an audience, or an audience will find you.
Well, Philip, thank you so much for coming in and participating in the Living Legacy Project at the Bridgefield Penny Art Center.
Thank you, Heather. Thank you for asking.